Good morning, friends. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted by Terry Wilson on the engineering. And Terry will be probably participating in our discussion today with our guest, Mac Burns. Mac, really appreciate you being here with us today.
Thanks for having me in.
We're going to be talking about the Astoria Megler Bridge is what we're going to be talking about, but it's the 50th anniversary, as I understand.
It is. This is the 50 birthday, 50 years.
Yeah.
It was dedicated in August of 1966.
It must have taken a real thrust from the community to get that structure built.
Well, that's one of the amazing stories, and we're actually going to do an exhibit that should open shortly at the Heritage Museum about this, that, you know, a lot of people, newcomers like me, to the community, we take a lot of the things in this town for granted, that we just sort of assume they've always been here or they just kind of happened. And this community in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington have been talking about a bridge spanning the Columbia River here at the mouth since the 1930s, maybe even a little bit before that. There had long been talk of building a bridge. It took a real concerted effort, and one of the groups involved that I think without their efforts, that bridge may not have been built when it was or may not even be there today, is the Astoria Clowns.
Yeah.
And people don't really make that connection or realize that. The Astoria Clowns had already done a few parades, but they were looking for a cause. And at the time, in the late 50s and early 60s, they were a group of business people. And they became the Clowns from Astoria. You clowns think that the rest of the state should pay for a bridge? And they said, yeah, we're clowns, and we do want you to pay for this bridge. And these guys spent, you know, every weekend away from their families and homes and businesses, going around not just in the area, not just down to the state legislature, but they were going around the state to every chamber of commerce or Rotary clubs or Kiwanis clubs. They were going up to Seattle. And they were advocating for this bridge. They might be in a parade as the clowns, but then they would go and speak about the economic benefits and how important it was going to be, not just to Astoria and Clatsop County, but to both states.
What did it cost to build the bridge?
Oh, see, I knew you were going to ask me real specific questions. and I don't know that I've got that information in front of me, but I am going to quickly look through. I want to say it was $24 million, but somebody's going to quote me on that, and I'm going to be wrong. But that number's sticking in my head. $24 million, that is correct.
I just found it on my sheet. A mere pittance in today's economy.
And the current work that ODOT's been doing on it is far surpasses that. If they'd left the toll in place, then they wouldn't have had to spend more money today to take care of the bridge.
Yeah, I remember when they removed the toll. I think Senator Joan Dukes was instrumental in getting that removed.
Well, that's one of the amazing things about this bridge that I love in our current climate of being cynical about government in general, maybe Congress specifically, but overall, you know, any government sometimes we're a little skeptical of. This was a promise made and a promise kept. They said, once this bridge is paid for, we will take the tolls down. And they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine such a thing today when you've got that source of income? I don't think very many government bodies would walk away from it today.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at the bridge today as it exists, it looks to me like, at least on the Oregon side, to build that approach, it must have really impacted that part of the community, that part of the town. And they must have had to remove a lot of people, lot of structures.
That's one of the things we're taking a look at in our exhibit, of how many houses had to be moved and what the impacts were on those streets right there.
Right.
So people have to come and check out the exhibit when it's done.
And that exhibit's going to be up when?
Probably in the next few weeks. We're still tracking down some information and waiting for some loans from some different organizations. We've got a lot of people helping us out. The Columbia River Maritime Museum has some artifacts, and ODOT has some artifacts, and there's some paperwork involved in moving things 20 blocks over to our building for a while. But the other thing we're trying to do is meet and chat with and get the stories of people that worked on the bridge, the guys that actually built the bridge. We've had two rounds of open houses where we've just put the word out that if you worked on the bridge, If you helped build that bridge, come on in and share your stories. And I wasn't sure what we'd get. You know, these guys have to be at least 70 years old if they worked on the bridge 50 years ago. And I didn't know if there was anybody still around or if they'd have stories, if they'd want to share their stories. And we've had probably a dozen folks now that we've been in contact with, and all different jobs. It's not just been a whole group of welders. It's ranged from an ODOT inspector at the time that was there every day checking on things to a fellow that owned the concrete company, the second concrete company after there was quite a lawsuit involved in the construction of the bridge, to one of the tugboat drivers that had to place the spans in space. Each span had to be boated in, and he was one of the tugs drivers that did that. There was also a fellow, I just love this story, there was a fellow that worked at Tongue Point, but the pay was so much better, he quit his job even knowing that he was only going to have a job for about a year working on the bridge. And one of his final tasks, the supervisor handed him a broom and said, sweep the bridge. And he had to go from one end to the other on foot with a push broom, sweeping the bridge.
Wow.
I try and get the Chamber of Commerce for the Great Columbia Crossing. They should have an award that anybody that'll carry a broom and sweep it, they'll get an award in his name or something.
Well, you mentioned a lawsuit involving a concrete company. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Apparently there was a concrete company that had trouble, and then a second concrete company took over.
Yeah, there was a DeLong company, I believe was the name of it, and the concrete for the where the spans are in, mm-hmm. the cofferdams, I believe they're called. I'm not an engineer, in case mm-hmm. that's not coming clear through the radio. I'm an historian. but the cofferdams weren't, the concrete wasn't the right mixture, or there's something mm-hmm. inferior about them. And there are all kinds of back and forth claims that, well, the plans we were given, this is what it called for. And no, you knew that it should have been this kind of concrete. And I'm not really sure of all the details, because this was a huge lawsuit. Mm. And there were just reams and reams of court documents. And again, we're historians. We're not lawyers or engineers. But a second concrete company had to come in and kind of finish it. And the bridge would have been finished probably about a year earlier had that not happened. In midstream, so to speak.
Right. Were there any fatalities involved in the construction?
You know, there's a lot of myth and legend about this, and people that you talk to are very adamant that either, no, there were no deaths whatsoever, there were some injuries, and then there are other accounts that, at least one guy got hit by something swinging and fell into the river and never seen again. And just the other night we had our first bridge talk, and I had somebody swear to me there that, oh, there's at least one body in that concrete. Documentation-wise, not really sure. There's some newspaper stories about some injuries and this one fellow, again, that got hit and fell into the river. So I'm not really sure. Not sure how to answer that. From the newspaper accounts, it looks like one.
Yeah. Well, that's actually probably not a bad record, considering the amount of hours that people spent on that thing.
Yeah. What I've never been clear on is how many total guys actually worked on the bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure crews came and went, and I mean, you know this from your own background, that you start a project and maybe you got five guys and two guys leave and two other guys come in before the project's over. So suddenly you've got seven guys that worked on this project,
right,
but only five at a given time. So I don't know how many really, really worked on it.
I'm wondering politically, how did they scare up the funding for this thing?
It went to the state legislatures. And again, that's where the clowns really worked hard. And there were the Port of Astoria was a huge advocate. The Chambers of Commerce were huge advocates, and our state representatives carried the water on this a lot. But it was a lot of selling. It was a lot of convincing that this was important, and it was. And that's one of the things about the number of people that ribbon cutting in August of '66 that I'm fascinated by. There were 30,000 people that came to experience that bridge for the first weekend. We had governors from both states. We had Congress people. We had Miss Oregon and Miss Washington were there. We had the city of Waldorf sent a contingent.
Wow.
And this was the first time that the sister city had sent a group of people over. Mm-hmm. I think the Burgermeister had come over maybe, and I know that our mayor Steinbach and our city manager had gone over, but this was the first, we're going to participate, we're sending a whole group over. And it was a big deal. It was a really big deal.
Yeah, I was here when the Burgermeister was here the last time. Actually, it's a Burgermeistress.
As I say, is it a Burgermeisterin now or something like that? I don't want to cause an international incident by referring to her by the wrong title.
Well, Mac, I'm sure you've got some other interesting stories there regarding the bridge.
Well, yeah, a few. I guess, you know, when we first started deciding we should celebrate this, we were going to do an exhibit, and I went out and got some funding, and we knew we were going to create this exhibit in the Heritage Museum that would be up for all year. But we started to get all these phone calls. What are you doing? What are you doing for the celebration? The Chamber was sending us phone calls. The City of Astoria was sending us phone calls. ODOT was even sending some phone calls our way. So I finally, about 9 months ago, convened a meeting and basically used our room, and we bought the donuts. And we said, is there something here that we should be celebrating? Mm-hmm. And everybody was emphatic and that we should. And everybody was kind of relieved that the Historical Society was taking the lead on this. But I've had a few people, really, a bridge? We're excited about a bridge? And there is reason to celebrate this bridge. So just for me, a few of the highlights. The bridge was the final link in a long-desired Trans-American Highway, a continuous, uninterrupted motor route between the Canadian and Mexican borders. This was the last route. Besides this bridge, you could get in a car at the Canadian border and drive straight through to the Mexican border, except for at Astoria Megler. You had to wait for a ferry boat to get across. So this it was a huge thing. At the time of the construction, it was thought to be the longest continuous steel truss bridge in the world. It represented an economic boost to Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. Commerce you could put on a truck could now cross the bridge that maybe couldn't get on that ferry. Yeah. That you had to drive all the way to Longview.
You know, there's a push now to bring that ferry back to Astoria.
There is, and I think that would be wonderful if financially it works out. I think there's so much romanticism about it. We were talking right before we went on the air. People remember that. They remember eating the hot dogs and the cheeseburgers on it. They remember it was a great babysitting service for a quarter. You could ride back and forth, and as long as you didn't get out, kids would come back over. It was a great cheap date, people tell me.
Yeah, well, I've seen pictures of it. It's in pretty good shape. It's up in, I believe, Bellingham, and there's definitely a move afoot to bring it back down here, but it's kind of unclear then what's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's still, I can't speak for them, and there's a whole group that's been organized. I think there's some thought about making it actually a tourist boat that goes up and down the riverfront, mm-hmm. Like the trolley. Or I think there's also, if that's too complicated or too expensive or the insurance is too crazy or whatever, I think it would be an attraction just park somewhere, and you could rent it and walk around it and remember your first date with your sweetie or something.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be neat to park it right at the foot of 14th Street, the original ferry landing?
See, I think that would be wonderful. Yeah, that would just be great.
And Terry, they'd probably have cheeseburgers on board.
Yeah, well, we were, as Matt said, we were talking before the show, and of course, I grew up in Long Beach, and it was really, in the wintertime, when the current was running and the wind was blowing, you'd come over to Astoria. The road to South Bend and Raymond was atrocious in those days. And what kind of shopping was there in Raymond, South Bend in those days? So you'd come over here, especially Christmas, go Christmas shopping. Mm-hmm. And the chessman or the tourist or two could not get into the ferry slip over on the Megler side, so you had to spend a night someplace in Astoria. I spent several nights in the Astor Hotel with my family, you know.
Yeah, and near the end, you know, as much as we romanticized the ferry and as wonderful as those memories were, there were many times that it kind of was not running. It would run into nets and get tangled. It would run on sandbars, and you'd have to wait until the tide changed, and people just kind of knew that was part of the deal. But especially by the 60s, late 50s and 60s, it was getting to be a real problem, especially with so much traffic. You got the World's Fair up in Seattle. There were backlogs, and the ferries just couldn't keep up. and there would be a line of cars on either side waiting. And that was really the bridge was necessary. I mean, as much as we liked the ferries, progress was just pushing that door down, and we had to build a bridge.
Well, at a very low tide, if you're going across the bridge, take a look at the Desdemona Sands. I mean, the sandbars that the ferries had to go around and through and whatever.
Yeah, and as great as Fritz Elfing was and the other captains, they still ran aground every now and then. And there's lots of stories of, well, bear with us, passengers. We'll have to wait a little while. And, you know, people understood it, but at the same time, you can't run your train that way. I love, there's a great line from the newspaper. So since it was in the newspaper, it must be true. At the time of completion, the newspaper claimed it was one of the most important milestones in the history of our community, alongside Robert Gray's voyage into the Columbia River, Lewis and Clark, and John Jacob Astor's establishment of a fur trading outpost here. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
I mean, they put it right up there that you've got John Jacob Astor, Robert Gray, Lewis and Clark, and building that bridge.
Well, I'd like to take just a minute to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted by Terry Wilson on the engineer, and we're visiting with Mac Burns from the Clatsop County Historical Society, and we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the dedication of the Astoria Megler Bridge. Yeah. What kind of celebration is it going to be, Mac?
Well, the committee that we've pulled together, and it represents, oh my gosh, I almost hate to start listing because I'm going to leave some group out, but sitting around the table at our last meeting, we had representatives from the Chamber of Commerce, the Downtown Association, the Columbia River Maritime Museum, Regatta. Oh my gosh, Regatta has really embraced this and made it their whole theme for this year.
Mm-hmm.
The Regatta Association, I think I said downtown, the Long Beach Visitors Peninsula, the Owako Museum over there, the school district, ODOT. ODOT has been huge, the city of Astoria. The list just kind of goes on and on and on. So it really is a community thing that's happening here. We've identified some key things that we would like to do this year. And then if we're hoping other groups and other organizations and businesses will find a way to embrace this, the year of the bridge to everywhere. Regatta actually came up with that tagline and we stole it from them because it was such a good one, the bridge to everywhere. But we are going to focus on, we've started already, Bridge Talks, a monthly lecture series, the second Wednesday of the month, 7 o'clock at the Lovell Showroom at Fort George Brewery. We just had one this week on the ferries, and our next one is going to be one of ODOT's historians, Robert Hadlow, is going to talk about the bridges of the Pacific Coast Highway. And I suspect he's probably going to talk about our bridge as well, since it is one of those bridges. And then we've been trying to get in contact with folks that worked on the bridge. We've had some open houses, and we're hoping to do a reunion of workers and their families. And then we'd like to recreate this dedication ceremony, ribbon cutting that they had. And we're going to do that during Regatta that Saturday morning. And we're still putting that together of what that means to recreate that ceremony. But we do know that Waldorf, our sister city, is so excited. They've already bought their plane tickets and they're coming.
Yeah.
And one of the guys is coming as part of that group because his father was here 50 years ago as part of the group. And we're hoping maybe we can find a car that's similar to the one his dad drove in. Part of our exhibit is certainly going to be talking about clown history because I do think they're such an important part of this story. And then one of the things I'm kind of excited about that we're just beginning to really get the details on is doing an education or an engineering day in the schools. Might be a balsa bridge, balsa wood bridge contest, and you smash them and see who built the one that can take the most weight. It might be a design thing. We're trying to find some engineers and some science teachers that'll get excited by that, offer some prizes to the kids, but try and get an educational component. To me, that's kind of vital that we have that that part. But other than that, you know, we hope that just like the Chamber of Commerce's annual meeting this year had a bridge theme, and certainly the Great Columbia Crossing will have a bridge theme. We're hoping that organizations get excited and find some way to celebrate 50 years of that bridge.
It's kind of interesting to speculate what changes in the communities were affected by the construction of the bridge. In other words, without the bridge, the Long Beach Peninsula was pretty much separate from mm-hmm. Clatsop County, but the construction of the bridge allowed kind of an intermingling of those communities.
A huge intermingling. For a few years ago, I was part of a group that was working on the notion of parts of Pacific and Clatsop County becoming a National Heritage Area. And I don't see that river and the bridge as any kind of a divider. I see it as a joiner. And I have just as much fun going to Long Beach and walking on their boardwalk as I do going to Seaside. Mm-hmm. I see this as one region, and rising waters float all boats. But along those lines, some interesting statistics. That first year that it was open, 1966, 206,000 vehicles crossed that bridge. Now, today, it averages more than 1.6 million vehicles that cross that bridge. It's about 6,000 cars a day, at least, that go across one direction or the other. So it's definitely one community, and people are going back and forth, whether they're tourists or whether they're commuting across it. The ferries never could have done those kinds of numbers.
Well, and it allows the Washington folks the opportunity to come over to Oregon to shop.
Exactly. And that's what our Chamber of Commerce, there's a few great quotations from the head of the chamber at the time talking about how great it is going to be and then how great it is for business after the bridge was completed. So it definitely had an impact.
Well, Mac, what other kind of plans have you got for this year?
In terms of the bridge or just in terms of the historical society?
Historical society.
Well, you know, we had an unbelievable year. We, for those that don't know, we operate four museums. We operate the Captain George Flavelle House, of course, our flagship, the Heritage Museum in the Old City Hall, the Uppertown Firefighters Museum. And 6 years ago, we opened the Oregon Film Museum. And 2014 was a banner year by far, about 20% increase in attendance across the board. And we were just kind of taking our breath last January, and then 2015 shattered those numbers with another 20% increase across the board. In total, the Historical Society serviced about 68,000 visitors last year. Mm-hmm. And we do that with a budget of about $500,000. And only $1,000 in tax support. So yeah, we have to generate that revenue by ourselves. So we've got a number of events. Casino Night fundraiser will be in April. We're looking at some homes tours, perhaps. And then in the fall, we always do Talking Tombstones, one of my favorites. This year, we may be going to Seaside. We're not quite sure. We're exploring that cemetery right now. We do old-fashioned fun and games on the grounds of the Flavelle House. But really, we're focused on getting this exhibit done on the bridge and kind of taking the lead in making this celebration for the bridge memorable and meaningful.
Well, is there going to be a function or some kind of a celebration that happens actually on the bridge itself?
You know, we had a long talk about that, and it's not an easy thing to close the bridge. And the general thought in the room was that the chamber does a great job with the Great Columbia Crossing, and that's an opportunity. I mean, for somebody like me that's not going to run across that bridge, I was still able to walk it and get up to the top there. To try and close it a second time, people were not really excited by that idea. Well, so the Great Columbia Crossing is your chance to get up there and walk it.
Yeah, but I mean, closing the bridge would give people a chance to pause and reflect about the impact that structure's had on the community.
You know, if a group of folks wanted to try and organize that, I'd be very excited. But all the parties that we had in the room were kind of frightened by that notion of trying for a second time to close it. There was even talk of well, maybe we could have people that aren't running during the Great Columbia Crossing walk from this end just up to the top and then back down again. And general feeling was too many fish swimming against the tide, and that probably was not a good idea.
So I'm wondering what else you've got going for this year.
Well, you know, we're always looking for volunteers, and there's always projects that we do. We put out CumTux, our historical journal. We take care of 40,000 photographs and 25,000 artifacts, and just trying to keep up with all of that. And I like to call it deferred maintenance. There's always things, as anybody that owns an old house knows, there's always things that need doing on your properties. And then probably one of the most exciting things, we're really looking at the Oregon Film Museum. It's in the Old County Jail, and it's a jail. It's really pretty small. And we're exploring how we might help the neighborhood up there by the Goonies house pull some people off of the hill.
Yeah.
And drive Goonies fans downtown to the film museum instead of pestering neighbors and trying to get through residential roads.
Yeah, that's been kind of a problem up there. Have you come up with any ideas to solve that?
Well, we're looking at our options and seeing how we might become a little more dynamic and a little more appealing to the Goonies fans and get the word out about us. My board president, Andrew Bornstein, has this great line that we've been open for 5 years, but he says there's more people from England have gone through that museum than people from Astoria. So you're just getting the word out to people that work in restaurants and gas stations and in the hotels to make people aware, especially the Goonies fans, that for your Goonies fix, go there. Don't go up and bother the neighbors.
I'm wondering what it is about the Goonies thing. It's almost a social phenomena of some sort.
You know, I wish I was working on a master's degree in sociology right now,
mm-hmm.
because we have this thing in the museum, we call it Leave a Note for the Goonies, and they're little pads of paper, and they ask leading questions. I love the Goonies because, I am a Goonie because, when I think of the Goonies, I am here today because, and people write little notes, and that was going to be just a temporary thing when we opened, and the messages that people leave are so... they're so emotional that we've decided to keep it up. And, you know, I've got dozens of, I'm here because this was my brother's favorite movie. Rest in peace, Samuel. I came from St. Louis because this was my friend's favorite movie. He died of cancer. And suddenly, you know, it's not a joke when you've got these people that this is a religious experience for them. And tons of were on our honeymoon. My boyfriend proposed to me on the porch of the Goonies house. I said, yes. And it's multi-generational. When we opened this thing 6 years ago, I didn't know what the age group was going to be, whether it was going to be people in their 40s that grew up watching the movie, whether it's 20-somethings that the movie's older than them. And it's multi-generational. We have people in their 60s and 70s coming saying, this was my children's favorite movie, and we're bringing the grandkids now to examine it. You know, I think it speaks to that friendship, the underdog, these were the outcasts, and yet they're the heroes. And, of course, it's an adventure, and it's Steven Spielberg, so that can't hurt either.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Goonies fans, it's a serious thing, and we need to remember that as a community, that they're buying plane tickets from Spain and coming over here specifically to see our town.
Mm-hmm.
And we love our town, and we should love sharing it too.
Well, it's just... to me, an interesting and almost bizarre phenomenon. anyway, the thrust of today's program was visiting with Mac Burns from the Historical Society would be to talk about the Astoria Megler Bridge. And we've just got a minute or so left, Mac. I wonder if you got any further thoughts there that you're looking at.
Well, yeah, I'd love to plug, if I can, two dates coming up. February 25th. Is another open house. So if anybody listening, if you worked on that bridge, if you helped build the bridge or you had a role in maintaining it, we'd love to hear from you. And it's just an open house. We'll provide the cookies. It's not just for fans of the bridge. This is only for people that worked on the bridge. We want to hear your stories. Come on in at 10 a.m. or 7 p.m. At the Heritage Museum, 16th Exchange. And then our next bridge talk will be March 9th. It'll be Robert Hedlow talking about the bridges of the Pacific Coast Highway.
Yeah, and what was the name of that designer of those bridges?
Well, you'll have to come on March 9th and hear from Robert Hedlow.
Well, friends, it's been a wonderful half an hour visiting with you here, talking with Mac Burns, mostly about the Astoria Megler Bridge, but about other topics as well. Engineered, of course, by Terry Wilson. Terry, have you got a little business to talk about there before we go to Albert Smith and his always wonderful Friday Folk Show?
Well, are you saying goodbye?
Yes.
Okay. This is the end of Jim's show, but we do have a new underwriter. You'll hear it in just a second.